Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds. It's my pleasure to present our guest speaker, Dr. J.S. Schuyler. He's a graduate of Jefferson Medical College. He did postgraduate training at Duke and the NIH. He's professor of medicine, pediatrics, and psychology at the University of Miami and deputy director at the Diabetes Research Institute. For 22 years, he was study chairman of the NIH Diabetes Prevention Trial and successor T1D TrialNet. He was president of the American Diabetes Association and vice president of the International Diabetes Federation. He was founding editor-in-chief of Diabetes Care and founding scientific editor of the International Diabetes Monitor and is senior editor of Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics. This morning, Dr. Schuyler's lecture is Continuous Glucose Monitoring and Insulin Delivery Devices. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Schuyler.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back here. I was just chatting up front. I think it's been probably 20 years since I've last spoke at one of these conferences here, and good to be back. The subject was picked by you folks, continuous glucose monitoring insulin delivery devices, and so I'm going to try to review that spectrum. I'll start with disclosures. They're here, and hopefully the CME office has them all on file so you can look at them again if you wish. We'll start with insulin delivery devices, and when we talk about insulin delivery devices, most people think of insulin pumps. I'm going to show you later they're not the exclusive kind of insulin delivery device, but this was the first insulin pump. This is Dr. Arnold Kadish of Los Angeles, and this was a pump he designed for himself. He had type 1 diabetes. It was a bit more cumbersome than most patients were willing to use. But the very first pumps that we actually use, this is one of our first patients using what we used to call the big blue brick, which is about the size of it, and it had a syringe on the outside that had the insulin, and then you pumped it through a catheter that injected under the skin. That also was a bit cumbersome, and going the wrong way here. And then they began to get smaller. This was the MiniMed 507, one of the first of the insulin pumps to really get commercial status and pick up on the market. It had an interesting feature, though. It was the first pump. There were a couple predecessor versions, but this one had a in its tubing a place where you could separate the pump and part of the tubing from the part that was in your body. And that was good for showers, swimming, sleeping sometimes, and sex. So all the S's. And people appreciated that addition to the things. This is the 508, the next version, and this actually had another interesting feature. It had a remote control. And that was great for women because if you wore your pump under your clothes and you had to go press a button to take the bolus injection before meals, you had trouble finding it and often had to run off to the ladies' room. But by having this on your keychain, you could avoid that problem. And this was a contribution to medicine by Miss America. Nicole Johnson was Miss America 1999, and she had type 1 diabetes and wore an insulin pump. And one of the judges was well aware of that. And after she won, he said to her, "I'm sorry, I watched you very closely, and I didn't see the pump anywhere. Where was it?" And she goes, "Well, I wore it around my thigh when I was wearing my evening gown and stuffed into my my top when I was wearing the bathing suit." And she had it hidden away like that, and that led the company to say, okay, if people are going to wear it like that, we have to have a remote control, and that came about at that point. The current insulin delivery devices or pumps are shown here. These are the ones on the U.S. market. Let's see if I get the right button here. Yeah. So this is the Medtronic MiniMed pump, the current version of the ones I showed you before, that still is the predominant pump on the market, although MiniMed has recently shifted to this version, And this comes in two different flavors, one that is just the pumping version, and one that actually has a hybrid closed loop built into that, where it controls overnight glucose automatically by having a glucose sensor, which we'll get to in a bit, attached to it. Animas was a J&J company which was on the market, and they withdrew their pumps from production and sales earlier this year, and are just withdrawing from the market completely, and not sure why. This is the Tandem pump here. They're a small company in California, and they too recently came out with a version that is not fully automated in terms of its overnight control, but alerts the patient when there needs to be a change, stops the delivery, but doesn't have it fully automated, and they're going to have the more automated version out next year. This is Omnipod. What you wear is just this part. All these others have that kind of tubing that I showed you earlier that goes into the body and it's attached to the pump. But with the Omnipod, you just wear this little bit. It's sort of a patch that you wear on your body, and you control it with a PDM control device, which is really an Android lockdown device that you have to be able to do that. And this one here is just a patch pump, but this one is not automated at all. It provides continuous delivery of a basal rate, and the patient presses a button to get 2 units if they want to take extra for meals. And you can wear that to deliver things. That's called the Vigo. So those are the ones that are on the U.S. market at the moment. There are several others that are threatening to come, but these are the ones that are there now. And the reason I say it, not all insulin delivery devices are pumps is because this is the companion InPen, they call it, which is the first insulin device that actually records and sends to your phone how much insulin you take so that you can keep track of that. And if you integrate that with glucose readings, you can actually have everything on the phone that you want to know about, and that may be beneficial to people. This one is out on the market already, but all three of the major insulin production companies, Novo, Lilly, and Sanofi, are working on their own versions of this device as well. And this just is a recent study in JAMA last year that actually looked at what happens to A1C whether you use injections or a pump. And you can see there's no difference for young children less than age 5, but in each other age cohort, there is a statistically reduced A1C for the people who are using pumps compared to injections. They don't necessarily do well. The teenagers still have lousy A1Cs, but they do get lower when they use an insulin pump. And the other thing that they did is they matched the groups according to age and gender and duration of diabetes. And when they looked at the match cohort or whether they looked at the entire cohort, either way, I keep getting the wrong button here. Either way, in terms of severe hypoglycemia or hypoglycemic coma or DKA or severe DKA, there was less of it when one used the insulin pump. So that's one of the arguments that the pump manufacturers put forward. Okay, so those are the devices. The continuous glucose monitoring goes back a ways, too. This is a picture of a postage stamp, which was then contemporary. This was 1971, 50 years after the discovery of insulin, and the Canadians issued their postage stamp, 6 cents, to celebrate that, insulin having been first isolated in Canada. And this was a picture showing you a version of a glucose sensor that was down to being the size of the postage stamp. Comes from Diabetes Forecast in 1972, showing you that you might be able to have an electrode-type device that you could insert that would measure glucose continuously. Well, that one didn't go anywhere, but the first one to actually come to fruition was this one. This is an implantable glucose sensor. And you implant this into the up through either the femoral or radial artery, and you implant it up and run it into the inferior vena cava, and then you leave it there, So you got this little thing wiggling around in your inferior vena cava. It was developed by the same people who developed some of the first pacemakers. And they said, oh, we put things in the heart like that all the time, but I'm not sure I'd want a sensor wiggling around inside my inferior vena cava on a continuing basis. But that was one of the first ones to be developed and put in place. The first usable one was the CGMS, or continuous glucose monitoring system, that MiniMed developed. And you can see here, it has the sensor going subcutaneously, and it's wired to a receiver that you wear on your belt. Here's the clip holding it to your belt. That was considered to be, you know, a little bit restrictive, and so their next version, they use telemetry to transmit the glucose reading from the sensor to a transmitter that then sent it to the reader. As time went on, many companies began to get into the business. This is Dexcom's first version, the 7 Plus continuous glucose monitor, and it has a display which also showed the trend arrow, what direction, how rapidly the glucose is falling. It's 160 and it's dropping, and with a single arrow like this, it's dropping between 1 and 2 milligrams per deciliter per minute. And this is a reading of the last 3 hours of blood glucoses, and you wear the sensor and transmit it to the transmitter. Around 2008, there were three such devices on the market. The one I just showed you. This is the updated version of the MiniMed one that I showed you previously. And then there was also the Navigator, which was out at that period of time. Subsequently, that Navigator was withdrawn from the market, and both of these have advanced to later generation devices. But using those three, the most important paper to start the field appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008. And this was a Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation study group that carried this out. They enrolled 322 patients, divided them up into three age cohorts. They had A1Cs between 7 to 10. When they started, about 80% of them were using pumps and 20% on injections. They were doing finger sticks an average of six and nearly six and a half a day. And they were randomized to either continue to use their finger sticks or to add to that continuous glucose monitoring. And they could use any one of the real-time sensors that I just showed you. And what they found was that in individuals who in that cohort were over 25, there was more than half percent drop in A1C with a significant p-value after 26 weeks of using these and doing nothing else different, just having that information to be able to make decisions. When they looked at the younger groups, the teenagers, there was no difference between the two groups, and the CGM did a little better, but not statistically so in the younger kids, 8 to 14. But they did a subsequent analysis, and what they found was that actually the change in A1C was related to sensor use. And in the Miami Dolphins Aqua blue lines here, you could see for all three cohorts, if you use the sensor at least 6 days a week, and most of them were using it 7, you got a significant A1C decline. And if you used it for less than 4 or 4 to 6, you didn't get really much effect. If you don't use it, it's not going to have any effect, obviously. And so this really demonstrated that from that study. If we go to current systems, Dexcom is up to its sixth generation of device. And the current version, which is shown here, here's the device you wear on your body. And it transmits either to a receiver or directly to your phone, either Android or iOS, or to various watches or Fitbits. And it lasts, the current version is 10 days of wear. No calibrations are required. No finger sticks at all are needed. As I say, it's both iOS and Android compatible. And it has the app, the transmitter, the receiver, and a three-pack of sensors. And it's approved for patients 2 and above. So that's one system that's on the market. And the other thing about it is that you can, from the phone, you can send the information to followers. So you transmit that through the cloud, and a parent can follow their child, or a spouse can follow his or her spouse, which is pretty good if, you know, because it alerts them for hypoglycemia. So we'll The alerts will go off for both the person and the follower, and so you know what's going on. And particularly useful for somebody who might be traveling by themselves and wants their spouse back at home to know it, or for children who are in school and the like, can be very helpful. You can also get your readings now directly on the watch. This is from Apple's announcement 2 weeks ago, not even quite 2 weeks ago, that they had the new version of the Apple Watch out, and you can read the your glucose readings directly on the watch with the arrows. You can even get the curve in there if you select to show that. This is showing you 1 hour, and it only had one reading, but it could show all 3 hours. So when you stop to look at the time, you automatically know your glucose, so it becomes unobtrusive, and people around you don't have to know what you're doing. This is the current version of the Medtronic MiniMed watch. This is the Guardian Connect, and it has 7 days of wear that it's approved for. Same kind of thing. In their case, there's no receiver. It goes directly to the phone, and you need to calibrate it with finger sticks at least twice a day to maintain it. But it, in addition to having the sensor and the transmitter, which is rechargeable, the previous one, you have to get rid of the transmitter after 3 months. Here you can recharge it, and it's good for a year. It connects to CareLink and also to Sugar IQ app, which is run by IBM Watson, to give advice to people. This is the kind of pattern you're getting. This is what you ought to do. And it's approved for individuals between ages 14 and 75. The third one that just came to the market in August is the Eversense implantable glucose monitoring system. The sensor here is fully implantable and lasts for up to 90 days. It transmits to a receiver which you wear on the body on the outside. So this goes into the skin. This stays on the outside of the skin, and it will vibrate or provide the information to your mobile app, which is on your phone, to get your real-time readings. This shows what it does. This is the sensor is being powered by the transmitter. The transmitter gives the power to it, so you have to wear the transmitter to keep the thing active. And then you get fluorescence from the device back that you read with the same transmitter. So it comes into that. So it's a two-way system. The sensor is powered by the transmitter, and the transmitter reads the fluorescent readings from glucose binding. And as I said, you wear it on your body, and it vibrates. There, it's vibrating very nicely to alert you. And you set on your phone. You can, as all of these do, you can set what you want for how high you want it for a high glucose alert. A target there, you can put your target level in there, and what you want for a low glucose alert. This is another current system. This one is not continuous. This is what we call flash glucose monitoring. They market it under the CGM name, and that's probably misleading. This is the Libre system. It has 14 days of wear, the longest approved system out there. Again, no calibrations, no finger sticks are necessary, but it also offers no alarms and alerts. So that's a potential disadvantage. Records the data every 15 minutes and maintains data for 8 hours, so that you scan the device with the reader that you have to put over the device to get a reading, and then you look to see what it is. And if you want, you can look back over what the last 8 hours are. And they warn you not to rely on readings for the first 12 hours that you put it in. You might, if you have need to during that time, you can do a finger stick. If we compare flash versus continuous, the real differences are this has alarms, this does not. This is, depending on the version you use, you can get 10 to 14 days of usage. Depending on which one you use, you're 7 to 10 days here. Here, there's no calibration. Here, you have to calibrate at least twice a day with the Guardian from Medtronic. You're supposed to calibrate 2 times daily with the Eversense implantable. And calibration is optional on the Dexcom G6, but it doesn't require any that you use it. And data transfer here requires a scan, and these are more passive, provided that you're wearing the transmitter, obviously. And that's particularly important for the Eversense, having it on top of it. One quick other warning about flash that people don't always appreciate is that it says in the operator's manual that 40% of the time when the device indicated that user sensor glucose values were at or below 60, they were actually in the range of 81 to 160. Therefore, be sure you check a finger stick before you take action. Okay, so let's look at some data with these current devices as to how well they're used. This is a study that was conducted by Roy Beck, who runs the Type 1 Diabetes Exchange and DirectNet Exchange. And he formed a group called the Diamond Study Group that looked at continuous glucose monitoring in adults who were not on pumps. They were just using injections. I showed you earlier in the JDRF study, 80% of the people were on pumps. So this one was chosen specifically to avoid that. And so they screened the patients. They used blinded CGM for 2 weeks and then randomized them to either self-monitoring usual care or to continuous glucose monitoring. And this was not blinded. The patients could then read it during this stage. And they started out with baseline A1Cs of 8.6. After 12 weeks, these had dropped in both groups, but more so in the CGM group. And at 24 weeks, that was sustained. So they demonstrated you get about a 0.6% difference in greater drop when you add continuous glucose monitoring as opposed to standard finger sticks. What they found was that patients, the use of this for 6 days or more days a week, six or seven, was in the 90% range. And 90 to 95% of all readings were captured, which is really important. And 52% of the subjects reached their goal A1C or reduced their A1C by 1% at the end of 6 months. So here, if the goal was less than 7, you can see 18% were getting there. If it was less than 7.5, 38%. An A1C reduction of greater than 1% was seen in 52%, or if you put them together, either less than 7 or reduction of 1%, that was also about 52%, more so than was achieved in the usual care group in both cases. And it did not matter how old they were in terms of the ages that were used. A lot of people said, well, older people are going to have trouble using CGM. That clearly wasn't seen here. The older group, which was defined as greater than 60, had the same 1% drop as the 25 to 60-year-olds. And time in range. This is has become a particularly popular reading for clinical trials, is how much time do they spend in the 70 to 180 range that is what is recommended. And in the CGM group, it went from 662 minutes a day up to 734. So they picked up quite an hour and a half more of time in that range. And if you looked at hypoglycemia, this is time median minutes per day. If you're looking at less than 70, you can see that dropped in both groups, but more so in the CGM group. If you're looking at less than 60, same thing was true. And if you're looking at less than 50, same thing is true. So you're dropping in all the cases and reducing the amount of time that you're spending in at low levels. This was another study presented in the same issue of JAMA last year. This is the GOLD study. This one came from Sweden. It was doing the same thing, again, multiple daily injections. And what they demonstrate here, this was a crossover study. So the people all started out with A1Cs up here at about 8.7, 8.8. The group that was first during the first period was going to receive CGM. This was a run-in period where they all dropped to about a little less than 8.5, and a little more than 8.5. And then the CGM group dropped further and stayed down. The conventional monitoring group was here, and then they switched. There was a washout period, and they both ended up at the same level after you took the CGM away from this group. And then when you gave the CGM to the other group, they dropped, and this group stayed where they were, demonstrating that it really was the CGM that was making the difference. And I think that's an important set of observations that support the same concept as the previous study. Now, the previous Diamond study was in type 1, but what the Diamond group did is a second trial in CGM in type 2 on multiple injections. And they again started out at around 8.5. And again, at 12 weeks, they dropped, in this case by 1% in the CGM group. And at 24 weeks, again, it was a 0.6% difference. So almost identically replicating what was seen in type 1 on insulin users. If you look at glucose monitoring, its effects overall in this meta-analysis of all trials, if you're using real-time continuous glucose monitoring, here you can see you get a beneficial effect that favors CGM when the outcome measure is A1C. If you're using flash glucose monitoring, it really doesn't have an effect. And if you look only at randomized controlled trials, again, the effect is sustained with real time. With flash, you don't see it. So the flash helps a little, perhaps, to keep patients alert, but doesn't necessarily influence A1C, perhaps because they're not flashing enough and taking a look at it. Okay, so those are the trial results. Let's go on and next examine A1C and hypoglycemia risk. The classic study, New England Journal, 1993, was the diabetes control and complications trial. They demonstrated that you could reduce retinopathy by lowering A1C. But what they found was that as you lowered A1C, you increased the risk of severe hypoglycemia, defined as seizure or coma or the need for a third person to intervene to help you. And you'll notice that when you get to an A1C of 7, the rate is 60 such events per 100 patient years. Or that means, you know, every one of the patients, conceivably, it could be more for other patients, every 2 years is going to have a severe event. And so that was a bit concerning, and a lot of people didn't want to try to push to A1Cs of 7. If we go to that JDF study that I showed you a little bit ago, and you look at the control group there, those were the groups who did finger sticks and didn't use CGM. Here's where they were. They were at an A1C just under 7.5%, but much lower in terms of this frequency of severe hypoglycemia. Now, how did they differ from the DCCT? They differed because in between, insulin analogs had become available. And now, instead of using regular NPH or regular Ultralente during the JDRF study, they were using rapid-acting insulin analogs, either Aspart or Lispro, and long-acting insulin analogs, either Glargine or Detemer. And by just having insulins that had more predictable action curves, that probably accounted for this big drop. If you add CGM to it, there were six subgroups that the JDRF study had. Here are all of them. And you can see even the group that got less than 6.5 for their A1C, here's the others. This is age and depending on the starting A1C for the three groups, all of them had much less in the way of severe hypoglycemia. So having these tools available, better insulins and continuous glucose monitoring, you can dramatically reduce the risk of severe hypoglycemia. And I'm going to show you some of that as I review for you the type 1 diabetes exchange data. I mentioned a bit ago that Roy Beck is the guy who runs that. He's an interesting guy. He is an ophthalmologist who also has a degree in statistics. And he started out by running the multi-center studies for the National Eye Institute and runs what he calls the JAEB Center, J-A-E-B, in Tampa, where he was the coordinating center for all the Eye Institute studies. But he happens to have two kids with type 1 diabetes, and so he also applied to run DirectNet, which was an NIDDK, Diabetes Institute, study, and he became the coordinating center for that and then got more and more interested in diabetes. And when the Helmsley Charitable Trust, you may remember Leona Helmsley, she's the one who left all her fortune to her dog, but the dog ultimately died, and the Charitable Trust now distributes its billions of dollars for things, and one of the things they set up was the Type 1 Diabetes Exchange. And so this just shows you they've enrolled now about nearly 60,000 people with type 1 diabetes across the United States. And one of the interesting things, they started in 2010 to 12, and then they were looking at current data in 2016 to 18. And what you see is the average A1C by age in typical patients with type 1 diabetes in the United States. And fundamentally, it sucks. I mean, we're really way high A1Cs here. As you get older, you know, this is mostly teenagers and children, but as you get older, you do a little better, but you still are not getting toward target as much as you should. In fact, if you look at the proportions who achieve an A1C target of 7%, you can see it's down to 25 to 30% at best, and much less than that in the teenagers, both in the early group and in the more recent data. And if you look at goal and you use the A1C goal for individuals less than 18 is less than 7.5, or over 18 it's less than 7, you can see not a lot of people achieving goal in at either time point. This shows you a curve of those broken out, so you can just sort of see it. And it looks sad. These are the adolescents and teenagers, huge bump, and they actually got worse from 2010 to the recent ones, as you look at it as a whole. And the other age groups are more or less the same, but it does give one pause for concern. If you look at it though by insulin delivery method in CGM group, you find something interesting. The green lines here, these are individuals less than 13, 13 to 26 and greater than 26. But in each age group, the highest level are people who are injections only. The next level are people who are on pumps only. And then the lowest levels are achieved by people who are in CGM, either with injections or with pumps. And you can see that, you know, in this case, the pump plus CGM did better than the injection plus CGM, but out here, the injection plus CGM actually did better than the pump plus CGM. So what one sees is, you know, and you'll notice that this is not just a few people. There's 10,000 people in the middle group, nearly 4,000 in this group, and over 6,000 in this group. So a lot of people contributing to this. And it shows you that you actually can do better when you put into effect the kinds of devices that we're talking about today. If you look at meeting targets, it's the same thing. It's just the numbers are higher in the yellow and magenta where you're using CGM, and lower in terms of achieving target when you're not using those. One of the other things that we've learned from this is that type 1 diabetes does not protect you from becoming overweight or obese. We often think overweight and obese is type 2, but a lot of people, you can see here, overweight or obese, you know, it's 30 to 40% of people up to age 26, and over age 26, it's 2/3 of the people are getting overweight or obese, which is similar to the general population these days. And is pause for concern. And insulin use may be driving some of that because insulin puts on fat. So it may be contributing to that as well. But the other thing that it does, it causes these people to have what I call type 1 plus 2 because they're getting features of insulin resistance from their adiposity that really make them behave in part like type 2s. And that's something that we need to bear in mind as we recommend lifestyle issues and or potentially add a type 2 medication to people with type 1 to see if we can overcome the insulin resistance. Here's CGM use in the type 1 diabetes exchange. And this is really dramatic. In the original period, 2010 to 12, you can see it was fairly low, 7% overall. And by 2016 to 18, it's come way up. It's 29% overall. And so many more people using CGM. The devices have become easier. They don't require calibrations. And so wide-scale use. This is severe hypoglycemia in the type 1 diabetes exchange by A1C. And one of the interesting things to appreciate, and this shows you the number of people in each group here, but What you see is that this is the likelihood of one or more severe hypoglycemia events, that seizure or loss of consciousness, reported by the participant in the last 3 months. And you can see even people 10 and 11, they're not much different in their rate than the people who are 6 or 7. It usually, you're getting severe hypoglycemia because you didn't eat and you took your insulin, or you exercised without keeping up enough carbohydrate. It's other things that do it rather than the A1C that you're starting from. You can drop rapidly, even though your ambient A1C is 11, into a severe hypoglycemic event if you don't take care of yourself otherwise. So it's important to remember that. Here, and this is not just true in the United States. These are the T1D exchange is in red. The DPV is an exchange, a similar exchange that's conducted in Germany and Austria, and the WACDD is the Western Australia Children with Diabetes Database, and that's in green. And you can see that the Germans and Austrians, they follow the rules better, and they have lower rates. That's not surprising, but overall, it's the same pattern. You can see that you can still get severe hypoglycemia even in Germany or Austria. These are event rates per 100 patient years, but you even get them with 10%, which is not much different in rate than what you see with the lower A1Cs. This is by age, in terms of the same reporting requirement. The older people get more, no question about it. And the reason they get more is they have longer duration of diabetes. If you look by duration here, you're losing your ability to detect hypoglycemia in part as you get older, and therefore you're more prone to having severe events. And it's the lack of the cognitive ability to detect it and to react quick enough. Here's status by severe hypoglycemia by pump use, also by age. And you can see pumpers do less than non-pumpers, same as what I showed you from the randomized trials in that meta-analysis earlier. And then we have DKA by age, one or more events in the last 3 months. And you can see people are still getting DKA, 4.3% overall in a three-month period. And again, we compare it with other groups. This time, the type 1 diabetes exchange is the darker one on this end. Overall rates are in red. That DPV from Germany and Austria are here in blue. And this time, the other group is the exchange from the UK, from England and Wales, in green. But what you see, basically, is the same kinds of patterns across all of them, that there's still people getting DKA in spite of trying to work on good control. And here's by diabetes duration. It's interesting that you have more DKA with shorter duration. We had more severe hypoglycemia with longer duration. People with longer duration are finally learning signals for detecting DKA and taking appropriate actions to try to prevent that, and that's probably very good. Here's occurrence of DKA by A1C, and not surprisingly, it's much higher as you get higher A1Cs. They're going to be able to slip into it faster because they have an ambient A1C, which is higher. Here's occurrence of DKA by CGM use, and you can see CGM reduces the risk of DKA by about half in each of these in each of these age groups. A little more than half if you look overall, 4.9% down to 2.1%. This is by pump use. You also reduce it. That's interesting because in older data, going back to the 80s and 90s, pump use was associated with more DKA, because we'd get occlusions in the tubing, and therefore patients would not be getting their injection. The tubings have improved, and the insulin formulations that we use have improved so that we don't get that as much anymore, not practically at all. And so therefore now pump users have less DKA than non-pump users. And here's severe hypoglycemia by CGM use. This got out of place. It should have been with the severe hypoglycemia earlier, but you can see here again, CGM reduces the risk of hypoglycemia. This just shows you over the period from 2010 to 12 to 16 to 18, there's been an increase of pump use, but it's been mostly in the younger individuals less than the age of 13 has had the biggest jumps going up, but it's occurring in all the age groups. And the pumps that are used, 53% are the Medtronic MiniMed. Now, remember, this was 16 to 18 data, and the withdrawal of the Animas from the market occurred in 18 after these data were collected. But they had 17% for Animas, 18% for that Insulet, which was the patch pump. Tandem had 12%, and Roche or other had 1%. CGM use has really increased during that period of time. From 7% overall use to 30% overall use, which you can see here by age, and that's going up rather markedly. And here you can see it by year, 2011 and 12, it was only 6 or 7% of people using it. By 2017, it was 31%, and it's probably a little bit higher right now. This is CGM used by insulin delivery method. Still, remember, it was two-thirds on a pump in the JDRF study. It's a little less than that now overall, but still is two-thirds in the very young ones. Children less than six, parents want to put everything on and make sure they've got everything under control. And this is the CGM used by type. In 2010 to 12, Medtronic was dominant. Abbott was still in the market, and Dexcom was there. In 2016 to 17, the market had shifted over to Dexcom, so that's probably pretty close to the current statistics. This does not include, because it wasn't introduced by then, the flash glucose monitor or the Eversense that I showed you, the implantable one. So that, how that will impact this remains to be seen. So those are where we stand with those things. Now the thing is putting them together for automated insulin delivery. And here is the first example of automated insulin delivery. This was the Biostatter glucose controlled insulin infusion system, which became commercially available in the 1980s. And this is a young gentleman in our group who was being treated with it during a clinical trial. And you can see it's a large bedside type device, not very convenient for patients, but useful in the hospital during surgery for insulinoma or during labor and delivery or other kinds of procedures. And that's where it found its little niche, but not enough to keep it very actively used. Then there was an implantable glucose pump. This would give the insulin into the peritoneal cavity. You implanted it in the abdominal wall with the catheter going into the peritoneal cavity. That has an advantage in that 50% of the insulin from the peritoneum is absorbed directly into the portal circulation, same place that the pancreas sends insulin. So that actually may have been more physiologic. And you used an external controller to control it. And this could be used with that implantable glucose sensor I showed you earlier that wiggled around in the inferior vena cava. And actually was used for that. Eric Renard in Montpellier in France did studies with that as a continuous closed-loop delivery system that really worked pretty well. And when Medtronic acquired MiniMed, the notion was, because they insisted that that all of the IP for the implantable system had to go with it, they bought all that, and one would have thought they would be coming out with a version of that fairly quickly to market. They bought it, and that was a product that they completely killed. And nothing more has been seen for it. It's sad. This just shows you what all the things you need to make everything work. So you've got to have some sort of glucose sensor. It's got to be transmitted to some device. It's got to control an insulin pump. And the device has to be very smart and have algorithms built into it. And so you have the peripheral devices, the pump, and the CGM being most of the things. If you're doing finger sticks, they can be collected into the device as well. If you're using a pen, that information can be collected. You might also wear a heart rate or an accelerometer rate, because that might influence decision making. And that goes into a patient and system state estimation and then provides either trends, alerts, and advice, a bolus calculator to tell the patient what to do, or automated closed loop, or remote monitoring and diagnostics. And that's a scheme developed by Boris Kovachev at the University of Virginia. That shows what it takes to get all the information into a pump to make decisions. There are a number of these systems currently in development. Tandem has one. Type 0 is the system that Boris Kovachnik developed. Insulet has one for their pump. Medtronic MiniMed has one. They actually have the hybrid version just with basal control already on the market. There is a company out of Boston University called Beta Bionics, which is trying to do it as well. A company in California called Bigfoot Biomedical. It's interesting, the engineer there is a guy who wears size 15 shoes. That's how they ended up picking the name. Kind of cute, a sidelight. And there's a do-it-yourself system that patients can use and that they can download the internal components for it if they have a continuous glucose monitor. And they also have an older version of a pump. Remember I showed you those 507 and 508 MiniMed pumps earlier, those you can hack into and connect the system to. The newer versions The one here you can't hack, so you have to have an old system to be able to use it, interestingly. But a lot of people are using the loop kind of system, including two vice presidents of JDRF itself that go out and are using it. And it's become popular. I don't know how many people across the world are using it. And then there's multiple academic groups, Cambridge, UK, University of Oregon, McGill in Montreal, and a bunch of others that are working on various systems. I think we're going to have automated closed-loop systems, automated insulin delivery systems on the market sometime either in late 2019 or in 2020. And so that may change the way patients look at these things. So the future then, this is the next exit on the Florida Turnpike is where the future is, and that is that, one of the great problems in diabetes has been, can the mouse get to the cheese and not end up hyperglycemic or DKA in the process, or here trapped by the mouse trap? I think it's possible, and I think we will get there, and this mouse may very well be successful, and so will our patients. Thanks. And we have plenty of time for questions, if you'd like, or comments. Yes, sir. Yes, it is. It's available on the market now. It's had a limited launch in a few cities. I don't believe they've come to South Florida yet, but they did launch in Denver, in Washington, D.C., and one or two other places. But they've been doing it slowly because they don't have production up the capacity to do a lot yet. But it will be coming. The feedback is that it doesn't quite last 90 days for the most part. They claim it in their advertising, it says up to 90 days, and they have a significant number of people are getting to 75 or 80, but very few are really getting to 90 yet. They're trying to upgrade the system and get one that can last as long as 180, and then they hope those will last at least 90 and or 120, but they're working on it, and I think they have good intentions, and hopefully they'll be able to expand beyond the limited launch sometime soon. Yes, sir. Yeah, there's been a lot of studies with SGLT2 inhibitors in type 1. Papers were out in New England Journal and in Lancet in the last few months with dapagliflozin and sotagliflozin. I'm actually part of a group that's going to present data with empagliflozin in type 1 a week from Thursday at the European Diabetes Meetings in Berlin. And what we found that I think is important, one of the things that happens with SGLT2 inhibitors is that many people reduce the insulin dose. And when they do, they're prone to euglycemic DKA. And that's been a real problem. And what we found in the study we're going to report next week, we looked at the commercial doses, 10 and 25 milligrams, but we also included a group with 2.5 milligrams of empagliflozin. And they got nice A1C lowering and smoothing of effect, more time in range, but without any DKA and without increasing hypoglycemia. So I think that what's going to happen is that people are going to be aiming for lower doses than what we've used in type 2, and they may come out there. But when I was talking about the insulin resistance from having type 1 to plus type 2, what I often do is use 15 milligrams of pioglitazone, which particularly true in somebody where you can either palpate a liver or feel a liver edge, because what pioglitazone does is dump all that excess fat out of the liver and relieve insulin resistance. And that you're taking so much insulin that you're really creating a lot of fat in the liver. And so I like pioglitazone for that purpose. But because you don't want to get edema and other things, it's best to confine it to 15 milligrams, I think, in that circumstance. I've also used some metformin in that circumstance, but I find that pioglitazone at 15 once a day is easier to really get effect. I think everybody talks metformin is the first choice and the best choice. I actually don't agree with that, because even in type 2s, to really get effective doses of metformin, you have to be on 2 grams a day or more. And if you use 2 grams a day and patients will tolerate it, it's a great drug. The average dose in the United States is 1,100 milligrams. nobody's, you know, giving enough of it, and therefore they're not getting the effects that they could get from that. I think it just becomes complicated getting those doses up if you're also taking insulin. So pioglitazone once a day at 15 seems to be a really good choice to overcome the insulin resistance when you have combined type 1 plus 2. Yes, sir. And pioglitazone, by the way, is also generic, so it's not very expensive. The closed systems, as a whole, are not implanted. They, you know, the patient can just put on their continuous glucose monitor and read it on their phone, and put on the insulin pump the same way. What they need is the algorithm, and that each of these is coming up with a different algorithm that's implanted in an app in the phone. Either a dedicated app, in some case, what Insulet has done is they've taken Android phones, and they don't have phone capability, but they do have a data capability, and they've been using those. The other companies are using standard phones, either iOS or Android, and it's just a matter of getting that set up. And I don't know, as they commercialize it, how much advice. I'm sure they'll provide all sorts of advice and training for people to do it, a lot of it perhaps online. The only thing that needs to be implanted is that implantable glucose sensor that I mentioned, and that's a simple office procedure that you can do. And one of the reasons they had the limited launch that somebody asked about is because they have a big giant tractor trailer that they take around, and they set up in each of the communities that they're launching, and you can go into the tractor trailer and you can be trained in how to do it. So if you wanted to do it, you go to the tractor trailer, you set up a time for that, you spend an hour there, they show you all the implanting procedure, and then you can start using it if it's launched in your area. And so I'm sure when they come to South Florida, they'll drive their tractor trailer first to Miami perhaps, then to Fort Lauderdale, then up here, and begin to allow people to get trained if they really want to use it. For continuous glucose monitoring in general, I think every diabetic patient should be using it. For implantable, I'm not sure yet because, I think that when I've talked to patients and tell them you can either use this one that you got to change every 10 days at the moment, hopefully soon up to 14 days, or you can have something implanted for 3 months, but you have to measure your blood sugar by finger stick 2 times a day. And with this one, you measure it, you don't need to do any finger sticks. They go, I'd rather give up the finger sticks and change. Yes, I'll change this every 2 weeks. It's easy. So it really depends on patient choice on those things. And so I think that we're going to see it evolve over time. In terms of the automated insulin delivery, I think one has to be a little more selective, and you have to have a motivated patient who's really interested and communicative and everything else. Other questions or comments? Well, thanks for having me.